From short film pioneer to romantic crime drama, Eight Them Body Saints and Disney epic Pete's Dragon, David Lowery's made a habit of examining the nature of identity, family, and relationships from altogether sideways perspectives. It's an approach that served the writer-director well, and one he uses to great effect in his latest offering, A Ghost Story. I'm Edith Bowman, and you're listening to Soundtracking, a weekly podcast in which writers, directors, actors, and composers discuss screen music. A Ghost Story stars Casey Affleck as the spirit of a recently deceased man who remains in the house he shared with his wife. It's scored by Daniel Hart, who David has worked with on many occasions, of which plenty more in a moment. Now, I loved this film, so before we got into the music, I asked David what inspired it. Here's what he had to say, accompanied by one of Daniel's cues called The Secret in the Wall. David, welcome to Soundtracking. Congratulations on your film, A Ghost Story. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
We'll talk about the music in a second, but if you wouldn't mind just if we talked a little bit about the film particularly first. I love the notion of it being from the ghost's point of view. You always get the other side of it. And
yeah.
This was a really tender portrayal. Can you tell me where the idea for the story came from, first of all?
It came from the image of this bedsheet ghost in an empty house. That was an image that I just had in my head and wanted to use in a movie, and I wasn't sure what that movie would be. But by and by, I sat down to write this one, and this is what came out. And it's a very amusing image, but it's also very tender and naive and bittersweet and melancholy, and it has all of these qualities that we associate with childhood, which is where I think that naivete comes from, because it is a child's Halloween costume, and yet it also is understood to represent a ghost, literally. And so I wanted to see if we could use that image that is universally understood to represent a spirit of someone who has passed away and remains on Earth for one reason or another, if we could use that image and imbue it with the actual qualities associated with our understanding of spirits, even though we're using, again, a child's Halloween costume to represent it.
Is it Casey the whole time underneath the sheet?
Not the whole time, but enough to where I feel comfortable just saying, like, hey, he can take ownership of that character.
Yeah, totally.
Our art director, David Pink, was exactly the same height and size, and you could actually look from a distance, you would think he was Casey. So he wound up wearing it initially in the scenes where the ghost and Casey are on camera together, and then when we did pickups and reshoots, he wore it as well.
You imagine just throwing a sheet over someone and filming it. It was quite a difficult thing, and there was quite a lot of specific things required.
Yeah, that was the hardest part of the shoot.
Film.
Yeah, it was just getting that costume.
Bloody ghost.
To make it look as simple as it looks required a lot of mechanical engineering, and underneath that sheet, there are a whole bunch of moving parts to make that shape just have the presence that it has. And it's not even a bed sheet. I mean, an actual bed sheet wouldn't cover you from head to toe. So it'd be
like a giant's bed.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a... It's a very specifically constructed piece of fabric that has, you know, rooms for the arms to move out and for the trail to trail out behind them. And my costume designer, Annelle, that was her life all summer last year, was wrangling sheets.
He's beautiful.
It's a beautiful image. I mean, it's like we knew that if we could make it work, that it would work.
Yeah.
And it took us a while to figure out how to make it work.
I saw it maybe a week and a half ago, and it's in my thoughts daily. There are things that pop up that make me think about it. I mean, I think that's a sign of a great film.
That's the best I could hope for as a filmmaker, is to have a reaction like that, so thank you.
It started so many conversations about the story, the performances as well, and the music. I've just been given a CD of the soundtrack, which fills me with joy. I have listened to it non-stop. It was important working with Daniel again on this, and And on this one particular track that almost stemmed the rest of the score for the film, am I right in thinking that I Get Overwhelmed was a track that he'd written for his band, with
yes.
his band, and then kind of formed the soul of the music for the film, really?
Yeah, I was developing the film. Like, I wrote it very quickly last year when we were doing the score for Pete's Dragon. And I, one day, was in the little office Daniel had in our post suite in the Disney lot, and he played the song for me that he had written for his band Dark Rooms.
Yeah.
And the title was very appropriate because I was just completely overwhelmed by it. I could not believe it. I mean, I've been a fan of his music, you know, that he writes for his band for years. Everything he's ever written has been great. But this was, you know, next level material. And I just couldn't stop listening to it. So I asked him to send it to me, and he did. And I was listening to it in my car. I was listening to it at home. I just couldn't stop listening to it.
Same.
And then I just wrote it into the screenplay. And at first, I wasn't sure how I would use it. I just wrote in a scene where Rooney was listening to it with headphones.
Yeah.
And then very quickly, it became part of the relationship between her and Casey's character. And, you know, I think everyone probably is familiar with, you know, when you're in a relationship with someone, one of the easiest ways to communicate early on is with music. You just understand a person so much more thoroughly when music is the common denominator. Proved very useful in terms of like trying to establish the emotion between them. We have very little time with them as characters in the film.
Yeah.
And this song does so much work in sort of establishing the emotional grounds that they stand on and the way in which they communicate to one another. At the same time, it also informed my ideas of what the music in the film could be. At that point in the screenplay, that scene where she listens to it was very early on. It was gonna be a scene at the beginning of the film. And when we got into the edit, it moved to the middle. And it was around that point, for me maybe, I don't know, I'd have to ask Daniel, but when he decided to start using pieces of that song as building blocks for the rest of the score, so that you know, when you watch the movie, you're hearing that song through the whole movie all the way up until you actually hear it. You don't realize you're hearing it, but you're hearing little bits and pieces of it.
So clever.
And then afterwards, you're hearing it again.
Yeah, it's such a clever way of using that one piece of music. I spoke to Nicholas Britell about working on the soundtrack for Moonlight, and he talked about how the same pieces of music are used throughout the three stories, and he's kind of chopped and screwed some of them and things like that, so you have this recurring thing. But it's so clever, like you say, that you connect with these melodies and these blurts of music that you kind of finally get to this point. It feels so familiar when you hear the song.
Yes.
And delivered brilliantly within the narrative. Casey's character a musician before you heard the track, or did it form part of the script?
He was an artistic individual of some indeterminate sort. And
describes a lot of people I know.
Yes, and as soon as I heard that song and wrote into the script, then it very quickly became clear to me that he should just be a musician. He and Rooney are basically playing my wife and I, but it was too on the nose to have them be a filmmaking couple. So making him a musician was the next best thing. You know, he learned that song, he learned all the words to it, and learned how to play it on the piano, and took it seriously and tried to make it look like he knew what he was doing there.
Well, it's totally believable, because going in and watching the film without knowing the background to it, I kind of watched it and went, God, Casey can really sing.
Yeah. He would be so happy to hear that.
Great voice.
Yeah.
Because you do, you think it's him.
Yeah.
That's the great thing about it, is that you invest in it and you're in that situation with him and you think it's him.
He does have a good voice, but we let Daniel's vocal tracks remain in the film.
Maybe on the DVD extras, possibly.
Yeah. Ironically, did you see too much? All the awful dreams felt real enough. Is your lover there? She waking up? Did she die in the night? Leave you alone? Love. Mirror, mirror, is your crooked nose boring here? A thousand wrinkles, no children, just emptiness. No place like home, just a fucking mess. 20 messages, you hurt your thumbs. What a stupid game, getting nothing done. With your longest track, your highest score, while you crush your back and lament the war. Also within the film, it's really important to know when to not use music as well, because there are silences and atmospheric sounds within that are almost as important as when it is to have scoring. Yes. The sense of silence in the film was built in. It was in the screenplay. And I knew there would be big chunks of film that would have no score, where you would just be listening to either room tone or to just natural sounds that kind of fade away into the background. And those are important. You need to have that space. If we had just like layered on score there, the movie wouldn't have worked. But it's just as important to like bring the score in at the right point at the end of those sequences. So like there's like a key scene that goes on for, I want to say, 15 minutes, where the ghost first comes home and there's no music whatsoever. And then at a very key moment, the score starts to swell in there at the end. And we spent a lot of time figuring out exactly what frame to bring the music in on, because you want it to hit at just the right point where it feels natural and earned.
Yeah.
Where the silence earns the right for us to hear music again.
Is that an emotional decision for you in terms of when you're watching it and making that decision? Is it about when it feels right?
It totally is. I'm sure there's some mathematics behind it that we could analyze. But for me, it's like I've got the track on the timeline and I just move it around and hit play, and if it feels right, then it's good. If it doesn't feel right, just nudge a little bit, hit play again, and just do that until I feel I've got it. of course, Daniel has his, he's part of that process because he writes the music to time code and he has his ideas of exactly where it should hit. And usually those are spot on, but every now and then, as always happens when you're making a movie, you're still editing it when the music's coming in. So things start to shift and you find new ways for the music to intertwine with the imagery, and those in and out points might move around just a little bit. But he's got a pretty good sense of exactly where the music needs to be in my movies. It's really kind of remarkable how little spotting we actually have to do. He just watches the movie and generally, like, he's like, yep, I got it. And
good instinct.
We've worked together long enough at this point that he knows what I'm doing.
There's some wonderful delicacies as well, and things that really stuck in my brain, the kind of sound of him kind of scraping at the wall, trying to get to the note, or I don't want to say too much in terms of giving things away, but there's a scene that involves the sheet. You almost feel kind of slight wind brushing.
Yes, all of that sound design, I'll give all the credit there to our sound designer, Johnny Marshall, who recorded most of the sound in the movie from scratch. When we were filming scenes that did not involve other human beings, we just weren't recording audio because the ghost was shot at a different frame rate, so there was no point to it. And I was always giving direction as we were shooting. It was like there was no need for audio on set. So all that sound was just built from scratch. And I wanted it to be very tactile. There were a lot of very specific sounds that we had to just experiment with. So every sound in the movie, for the most part, is created from scratch, and with the exception of the dialogue, and every now and then there'd be like a random sound effect in the background that was appropriate.
Yeah.
But most of it was just built in, and that's musical in its own right. Like, all the sound design functions to me in the same way that music does. Even though you don't process it as music on a conscious level, that's what it's doing.
The person who probably got the most dialogue in the film, Will Oldham, who has a great scene where he's kind of like a prophet sat at the kitchen table, regaling the world with his...
vaguely inebriated pop philosopher.
Yeah, it's great. I like that. But I had no idea that he was Bonnie Prince-Billy, who I've been a massive fan of.
Oh, yeah.
Musically.
Same here.
For a long time. And you guys have obviously worked together over the years on a number of projects as well.
Likewise. He's one of my favorite, if not favorite, American singer-songwriter, folk artists. And, you know, I've been a fan of his for years and years and years. And when I made this short film back in 2011, I just wrote to him out of the blue and asked him if he would be in it.
Was that Pioneer?
Yeah. And... I found his email address and just got in touch with him. And he said, yeah, he read it. And that's the type of guy he is. Like, if something appeals to him, it doesn't matter that some dude from Texas is emailing him out of the blue. He'll engage. So he was in that film, and that film did very well and kind of paved the way for everything else I made.
Hey, buddy. Buddy. Hey. Come here. Oh. What's wrong?
Bad nightmare.
You just having a nightmare?
Yeah.
Oh, buddy, that's so terrible. What can I do for you? Can I get you a glass of water?
No.
You sure?
No.
You gonna try to go back to sleep?
No.
What do you want?
Read me a story.
You want me to read you a story?
Yes.
Okay. What should I read? Want me to grab a book?
No.
What do you want?
Read me a story about Mommy.
That's a long, long story. You sure?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, where do you want me to start?
At the very beginning with the ships.
With the ships. Okay.
And he then contributed a song to Pete's Dragon, like the opening song.
The Dragon song.
His. Yep.
And we love that film.
Oh, thank you.
My boys and I.
I love it too.
Yeah.
I really am proud of that movie.
Yeah, it should be. It's beautiful.
Go north with the winds on your feet. Go north with the wind where the three rivers meet. There's a clearing of sorts in a circle of trees where the wild constellations shine one, two, and three. Look all around you and see, deep in the forest there dragons will be.
And when we had this scene, you know, in this movie with, you know, the most dialogue in the entire film, I knew he would be able to kill it, and indeed he did.
From working on something like Pete's Dragon, you mentioned being on the Disney lot, being in that enormous world, but still feeling, for me, Pete's Dragon feels like an independent film.
That was the goal, like to make something that felt like one of my movies, and that's just the way I make movies. And so even though it was a huge budget and we were working with all these visual effects and everything, I was still making it the way I always make movies.
I need to get back to him. He gets scared when I'm gone. Is Elliot a person?
No. He looks like a dragon.
What's a dragon?
I can't think of a better way to demonstrate that than like the fact that we had a Bonnie Prince Billy song kicking the movie off. Like, no one at Disney knew who he was. You know, I wrote that song into the script and I was like, this is who should sing it. And everyone got excited about that. And
right.
And that's just really wonderful that I'm like now able to introduce an entire generation of of children to a great American singer-songwriter.
Eight Embodies Saints is wonderful, and I love that scene where it starts off with Casey writing the letter, his character writing the letter, and you have the kind of violin and the hand claps kind
yeah.
of going on, and then the just abrupt ending that happens with it and stuff. I like as well with the music with that, how where a ghost story, the score isn't really of the place,
yeah.
whereas Eight Embodies Saints, you know, there's that country vibe
yep.
to it, folkness to it as well. Does that make it easier or harder when you're talking about music? Is it easier when it's, I don't know, there's a connection between location, genre, time, all that kind of stuff.
A little bit. I mean, Daniel always comes out to the sets when we're shooting our movies and just kind of gets a sense of what we're doing. Like, we just finished shooting a new one and he was there for 3 days and just wanted to pick up on the vibe of what we were doing in
yeah.
advance, just to kind of get those wheels turning. With that movie, with Ain't the Body Saints, the whole movie was designed from the get-go to feel like a folk song. It's like in multiple verses and it's like, you know, any classic outlaw ballad. That's like what that movie was meant
yeah.
to feel like. And so the music naturally just went in that direction. We didn't even have to, you know, talk about it that much because it was just so clear that that's what the idea was. In the case of that movie, even that scene you were talking about, Daniel was writing that music as we were editing that. So that scene was actually edited to the music. And the whole movie was. Like, he would send us a piece of score because he works very, very quickly. And we would just cut the movie to that piece of music. And so a lot of times the music was coming in before we had the scene finished. And it really ingrained itself in the movie that way, which is unusual. That's not normally how, you know, you work when you're doing music for a film. It's usually the film's pretty much done.
Yeah.
And it was really exciting to work that way, just to have that sort of like completely side by side, you know, in step process with Daniel. It did make it easy on that one, and with a ghost story, we're like, okay, what's the tone of this movie? What's it going to sound like? But luckily we had I Get Overwhelmed. Like, we knew that whatever the movie was going to sound like, it was going to come from that song. I just knew, like, if that song's in the movie, that's going to define the movie. That's going to be, like, the heart of the film. And so the score should just branch out from that, but always fall back on that. So we knew at the very least we had that as our bedrock.
For you as a filmmaker, when you first started falling in love with watching films and how you connect with them, were there certain directors or films that the music really resonated with you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I guess the easiest way to talk about that would just be the soundtracks that I bought when I was younger.
Yeah.
The Last of the Mohicans, the Michael Mann film, has just one of the most exceptional scores of all time. And that was one that I had a copy of early on, like on cassette tape back when, because I didn't get a CD player until I was in high school.
They're having a renaissance, cassettes.
Oh yeah, no, they completely are. But that's Trevor Jones and Randy Edelman collaborating on that score, and just, it's a masterpiece. Like, it's such a great score, and I'm surprised they don't use it like in trailers. That music is just so powerful. one of the first scores I fell in love with. The Danny Elfman stuff with Tim Burton definitely was huge for me. Edward Scissorhands still remains one of my favorite scores.
Stunning.
I had the Star Wars scores on vinyl as a child because I was obsessed with Star Wars and a lot of Disney scores. But another one that was formative for me was the Lost Highway score that David Lynch put together. I was probably 16 when that came out, and again, I got it on cassette tape. And that was the first film that was using songs in the film that I connected with personally. That was a bunch of artists like Nine Inch Nails and Smashing Pumpkins that I was really into then. Seeing them utilized with David Lynch's imagery on screen was incredibly exciting. You know, at that point, I'd seen some Scorsese movies and seen like how Scorsese used music, but that wasn't my music. I liked the Rolling Stones, but that wasn't my music. But all of a sudden, I was seeing music that spoke to me being used in a movie that spoke to me, and seeing how those could be used together was really profound, and that was really exciting. So that was another early cassette soundtrack that I had.
You don't really use needle drops. It's not something you've really done in your...
I haven't, and when we do, it's all original music to date. My co-writer on Pete's Dragon, Toby Habrex, who has also produced everything else I've done, he is a songwriter as well. And
we've all got writing credits on some of the tracks for Pete's Dragon.
Definitely. Usually I've just had him and his friends write the needle drops that we have. So in like Pete's Dragon, there's a Lumineers song, and Toby wrote that with his friend Andrew. Nobody knows.
try to say goodbye. It seems so easy till you try. Then the moments passed you by. Nobody knows how to say goodbye. Nobody knows how to get back home. We set out so long ago. Search the heavens and the earth below. Nobody knows how the story ends.
And we are making a film right now that I think will be the first film that we've made that will have like other music in it,
yeah,
that we did not originate. And so it's fun to sort of like start doing that. We have a Jackson C. Frank song that was written into the screenplay, and we're using that as like the starting point. From there, we'll see what else we find. But usually it's all, you know, when there are needle drops, they're all original songs and they're meant to like kind of fit into the score.
I find it quite refreshing actually when, I don't know if it's the easier option of just kind of going, stick a tune in there.
It's easy because you have attachments to it already. You know,
yeah, exactly.
There's a built-in history. And so you, if you play a song that everyone already likes, you're going to increase the chances that everyone likes the movie. You're hearing a song that makes you happy. And so that by cause and effect,
happiness.
Yeah, you're going to like that part of the movie.
Yeah.
So it is easy. There's no denying that it works. I mean, when I go to a movie, the same with like going to see Lost Highway when I was 16, hearing these artists who I loved, like Nine Inch Nails, and that made me happy. And it worked with the movie and it complemented the movie. So when it's done right, I have no problem with it whatsoever.
What can you tell us about the new project? You say much? Or?
Yeah, it's called The Old Man and the Gun. It's a true story, loosely based on a true story, that I adapted from a New Yorker article by David Gran. It's online if people want to read about it. And it stars Robert Redford in what he says will be his final role as an actor, although I wouldn't be surprised if he popped out of retirement in the near future. It's a completely different movie from a ghost story in every possible way. To be honest, it's basically a love letter to Robert Redford. he's playing a character, but I also like am very aware that the character has, you know,
a lot of connections
to him. So he's playing a bank robber, but it could just as much be a him playing an actor, you know, who's getting away with it. I worked with him on Pete's Dragon, and we'd been developing this project for a while, and it was just a real, you know, it was really fun to make a movie for him and to let him shine. And so that is probably going to be out sometime in 2018.
Awesome. He's such a kind of bastion for filmmakers and new film, you know, with what he did with what he's done with Sundance and things like that.
Definitely. It's an honor for me to get to work with him because he's a legend, but also because what he created with Sundance is kind of the reason I'm here. I had a lot of support from the Institute and then Festival played my short film, and I don't think, you know, I would have a career if it wasn't for Sundance. So it's great to some extent repay the favor by hopefully giving him a really great role in a really fun movie.
What's he like to work with?
He's great. He's never for a second not a living legend. You know what I mean? Like you never have a moment where you're like, oh, that's not Robert Redford. That's just a guy. Like, it's always just like Robert Redford. He comes up and says good morning with that voice, and you're like, oh, you are a movie star who I've been watching my entire life. But once you get past that, he's very down to earth, very kind, and doesn't have like a huge movie star ego. He walks on the set. He's got a little folding chair. He sits there and reads his paper until you're ready for him, and then he comes and does his work, and he's all about doing the work. Like, he really like likes to roll up his sleeve and do a good job. But you never for a second forget that's Robert Redford right there reading his paper in a little folding chair in the back corner of the set.
Have you got a favorite Robert Redford film?
Downhill Racer is my favorite, and not a lot of people have seen that.
Mm.
My memory of it, I haven't seen it in like two or three years. It doesn't actually have a score. it might have some needle drops in it. I mean, obviously, when you think about classic Robert Redford music, you think of Raindrops Falling on My Head.
Yeah, from Beach Cassidy, yeah.
And I think he actually doesn't like that. He wasn't a fan of that. I mean, it's an amazing scene. Like, yeah. But I think, if I recall correctly, Redford was not in favor of that choice.
It's like a music video
in the middle of the movie. The movie stops for a scene where Paul Newman is riding a bike and just, you know, horsing around with that song playing. It's kind of radical and revolutionary, and I love it.
I'm selfishly then going to pick something from All the President's Men.
Oh, perfect.
And from David Shara's score.
That's an amazing score.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely.
One of my favorites.
All the President's Men has a lot of really amazing scenes of people talking on the phone, and so does the movie we just finished. At first I was like, man, do we have too many scenes of, because there's a detective in the movie and all he does is make phone calls, and I was like, do we have too many scenes of him on the phone? And then we were like, wait, All the President's Men does that. They set the precedent. It's totally fine.
David, I can't wait to see it, the new film, but congratulations on A Ghost Story. It is absolutely wonderful, and it's a real pleasure to chat to you.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure for me as well.
As chosen by me, that's an extract from David Shara's score for All the President's Men, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with David Lowry. A huge thanks to David for taking the time to talk to us. A Ghost Story is on general release now, with Daniel Hart's score available via Milan Music. Both come highly recommended. Head to edithbowman.com to subscribe to the podcast and catch up with all of our previous episodes and find out about the music we've played. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK, and please do tell your friends about us if you like what you hear. Next up, well, it's only Clint Mansell. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.